Aveto from Janet Mills. This is Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz with Steve Missler and Mal Leary. And yes, the Democratic governor has been sent a bill she didn't sign. Instead, she did as Maine's constitution provides to, quote, return it with objections to the house in which it shall have originated, unquote. Mal, what was this bill Governor Mills vetoed, and why did she veto it?
Well, to begin with, Erwin, I don't think it's the last one we're going to see. That's because the legislature is a separate branch. And in this case, they took up legislation that would ban the increase in the amount of ethanol that's in gasoline. This has been an issue that's been around for decades. We started putting ethanol into gasoline to create less pollution when you have that alcohol mix. There's another mix out there now which increases the percentage of ethanol to 15%. That raises concerns among a number of folks, everything from folks with ATVs to, you know, your fishing boat and with its little outboard motor. They don't like that amount of alcohol in there. So what the governor has done is basically said, this is premature. Nobody's proposing to sell this in Maine. No one is selling it in Maine. We don't need this legislation. We'll just continue with the current legislation that authorizes E10, and we're not going to worry about banning E15 until such time as someone actually proposes using it to improve pollution. Now, most times that would come from the federal government, but I would say I don't really expect that the Trump administration is going to be taking steps that would try to improve the environment, given their track record so far in the last couple of years.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that this is, of course, probably not the last bill she's likely to veto. Are there any others you can see that look like they may be problematic in her eyes coming down the road?
This week, the House of Representatives voted, but the Senate hasn't acted on yet, making Election Day a holiday. Well, there's some unintended consequences there in terms of municipalities having to pick up costs that will likely occur because even though the bill only applies to state government employees having the day off, there may well be other folks follow, be it businesses, be it municipalities. So there's a lot of concern there. Whether that bill ever gets to her desk is another question, but that's the sort of thing she might look at and say, no, we don't need to pass on this expense right now. I think you're going to see, if the Democrats in the legislature pass a tax increase, I think you're going to see a veto from Governor Mills. She's made it very clear, no new taxes. She's not going to go along with them. That doesn't mean she might not go along with a fee, for example, in motor vehicle registrations to try to help out there. But in terms of an outright tax, I don't think you're going to see her sign any of those. Indeed, I'm pretty sure she'll veto them if they get through the legislature.
Now, it's kind of still early in her term, but it's probably, I would guess, a safe bet that she'll have trouble catching up to Paul LePage in the great veto race.
That's for sure.
This also comes as the pace is quickening at the State House. Steve Missler, what else has been going on up there?
Well, I mean, since January, we've been basically in a status where there's a lot of committee hearings, and then the legislature will come in twice a week for actual session days. Those two-a-week sessions are about to disappear. We're going to be moving into 3 days a week of actual floor votes. This is pretty normal in the sense that, you know, once the committees are starting to finish up their work, I think most of them are more than 60% of the way through all the bills that have been referred to them. Those bills end up going to the House and Senate. And that means that the House and Senate needs to meet more frequently in order to dispatch those bills, either pass them or vote them down. In addition to that, I think what we'll see is the budget process, which determines the end of the session in many ways. Those negotiations between Republicans and Democrats will really increase in intensity. And so I think that's what we'll be monitoring as the weeks and final months of the session come to a halt. And the big question is can we actually get out of here by the middle of June, which is when the scheduled adjournment is slated for? So this is sort of the final leg of the legislative session. And that means that some of the most high-profile bills will be coming to the fore, as well as the budget.
Well, speaking of high-profile bills, there was action in this past week on an important non-budget item, a rewrite of the state's vaccination laws. Steve, bring us up to date on that.
This bill, which has really emerged as perhaps the biggest political flashpoint of the session, is a bill that would essentially remove most non-medical vaccination requirements for school kids to attend school. Maine is among 17 states that allows for a philosophical exemption, and among a majority of states that also allows for a religious exemption. Now, this bill would remove both of those. That bill was approved in the House late in April. Then it moved to the Senate yesterday for a very, very interesting vote where Democrats, who have the majority there, passed the bill, which sort of moved it forward, it seemingly put it on the fast track to get to Governor Mills's desk. But then something sort of unexpected happened, which is that the Senate voted by one vote to restore religious exemptions. And the procedural significance of that is that the Senate and the House are now at odds. And if they can't reconcile their differences, that bill will stall. It will not get to the governor and it won't be put into law. The other piece of this is just that shows the sort of the perhaps the lobbying clout of the Christian Civic League. They put out an action alert. They had called their members to arrive at the State House yesterday to lobby lawmakers to restore this religious exemption. There's a lot of Democrats even that I spoke with preceding the vote that were nervous about getting rid of the religious exemption, not the least of which is the fact that only three other states have gotten rid of the religious exemption, although there are more that are considering it, including Vermont, which is has a similar bill to Maine's in their legislature. It was a bit unexpected in the sense that we expected that bill to move forward, but we didn't expect it to move forward in a completely different posture than what the House has previously passed.
Yeah. I think it's important to point out the House rejected a similar amendment that would create that exemption. So you've got this battle set up now where the Senate's passed one version, the House has passed the other, and we'll see who's going to blink. This is one of those procedural nightmares, Erwin, we'll be trying to explain for several days as we go through the machinations dealing with whether we're going to have that exemption or not.
I was just going to say, I'm glad Mal brought up the fact that the House had rejected the religious exemption restoration. It was a narrow vote, though, right? So maybe they can move, maybe the advocates for restoring this can maybe move a few more Democrats, because obviously a few went along with it a few weeks ago.
And it is interesting that the pressure here comes from the fact that if the two sides don't agree, there is no bill. And of course, if they do agree, they're either going to choose a religious exemption or not. So yeah, it'll be something to continue to watch.
The context here is that, you know, Maine CDC has put out that the state is dipped below that all-important herd immunity rate, which is one of the reasons why there was so much impetus for this bill to begin with, is that there's some concerns that with these outbreak of once eradicated diseases like measles, Maine has one of the highest instances of pertussis, that this bill is very important. There's a public health issue here. And so if the bill doesn't go anywhere, we will be right where we are now, which we're teetering on that edge of not having herd immunity.
Governor Mills also convened two cabinets this week. Essentially, these are groups of state officials and some other stakeholders to focus on government action in a given area. One will try to make recommendations that will help children. The other, the governor's climate cabinet, goes a generation further.
In the not-too-distant future, my grandchildren and yours could reach my age and live in a Maine that we would not recognize. So we must act.
Steve Missler, what actions will this climate cabinet look at?
It's designed to basically reduce the state's overall carbon emissions by, I think it's 80% by 2050. And it's going to evaluate various ways to do that. Some of that will be through recommendations to localities of how they can prepare for climate change. It's basically a planning document in a sense. And also it'll evaluate the carbon reductions of energy projects. The bill has an implicit goal of increasing Maine's reliance on renewable energy over time. And so the only way to evaluate whether or not we're hitting those benchmarks is to study the carbon effects of bringing those projects online. Interestingly, this evaluation will not include an evaluation of the CMP transmission line, even though we don't get any power from that directly. That proposal is already in the regulatory pipeline. The governor has already made it clear that she's convinced of the carbon benefits of that project. But her response to a question that we asked was interesting in that I think it was a bit of an uncomfortable question to even bring up that project in that setting. But if you look at the governor's Facebook page, a lot of people are talking about it. Why, you know, if we're going to have this climate council and put an emphasis on reducing carbon emissions, why aren't we evaluating this big project that's going to be running through the Maine's western woods? The governor's taken the position that there's already been enough study of that project and its climate benefits. Of course, there are Democrats in the legislature who disagree with that, although they were conspicuously silent when the question was brought to them when she unveiled her climate council.
And I think it's important to point out, Erwin, this is another council. All they can do is talk and make recommendations. It's still going to be up to the legislature to take any actual steps that will result in Maine lowering its footprint. The real problem, as we've said many times before, is most of the pollution that comes into Maine comes from downwind, comes from other states. So the problem is really a national problem. And this climate council that the governor's created is kind of working around the edges, because the big issues are still going to be those huge coal-fired power plants that are still being used in the middle Atlantic states.
Yeah, I think it's important to add, too, that this initiative is sort of mirrored in other states, especially states where Democrats control the legislature or the governor's office. And it's really, I think, it may be more of a statement that the federal government is doing nothing on the issue of climate change. And so the states have come out with various greenhouse gas reduction targets. They're updating those. They're also making commitments to renewable energy. I mean, the governor herself even said that the federal government is doing nothing, and so the states have to do the heavy lifting. And so Mal is correct that this climate council has very little rulemaking authority. It can only introduce them and have the legislature pass them, which is not that much different from what the DEP could do, right? It's a statement that this is an important priority for this administration and the state. Its tangible effects may be limited, however.
All right. Finally, some Democrats are starting to call for Attorney General William Barr's resignation following his testimony this week. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says Barr lied to Congress, not in his most recent testimony, but back in March when he testified he didn't know anything about Robert Mueller's reaction to his characterization of Mueller's findings. And as we learned on the eve of this past week's hearing, Barr had a letter from Mueller saying he thought Barr's presentation of the report's findings lacked context. So, Mal, Steve, any reaction to all of this from Maine's members of Congress?
Well, Shelley Pingree, I think, predictably said Barr ought to resign. What was more interesting to me was Jared Golden's comment, which seemed to mirror Susan Collins' comment, which found the statements troubling. Now, I'm not exactly sure what that means and whether that will translate into any action against Barr, but both of them are troubled. The reality is we're talking about a constitutional challenge here between two co-equal branches of government. And we've talked about this before. We've seen it here in Maine where Governor LePage wouldn't let commissioners go testify before committees. Now we're seeing stories out of Washington where Trump is saying, I won't let any of my staffers go testify at any of these hearings. Not going to happen. They're not going to do it. I'm going to block it. So we're seeing some of that play out at the national level. And I'm just not sure much is going to happen in moving forward, because you're going to have the question of any subpoenas that the House actually issues, they're going to end up in court and probably the Supreme Court. And we know that the Supreme Court, you know, acts with all deliberate haste, and God knows when they would get to those bills.
Yeah, I think what I was struck by is how this dispute up with Attorney General Barr and Democrats, it just feels like another layer in this whole controversy, but yet it's so granular in so many ways and so Washington, D.C., that I'm not sure the average person even understands the significance of what happened the other day when Barr testified. I mean, at the end of the day, I understand the politics of it, which is that the attorney general is supposed to be representing the rule of law. He's the top law enforcement official in the country. And what he was being accused of effectively was being the president's lawyer and not, you know, the lawyer for the Justice Department. And that's really the central issue here. You know, how did he shade or color the Mueller report when we didn't know what the Mueller report actually said? And that's really the conflict. And so a lot of Democrats, including Shelley Pingree, are really upset that they believe that he misrepresented the contents of the report and was able to shape the narrative for a few weeks while that report remained secret. But the report is out now, and everybody can read that document for themselves. I would encourage them to do it. It's very, very illuminating, even if a lot of what is documented in there happened right before our very eyes. It is important, and it's very thorough and well done, and it really illustrates what is probably the most important thing, which is how the Russian government, the steps that they took to try to influence the 2016 election, and that threat has not dissipated. And so perhaps while the focus is on Trump and what he did, that makes total sense to be continue to scrutinize that. But the federal government at some point is going to have to get together and figure out how to deal with this ongoing threat.
To follow up with that, both our senators serve on the Intelligence Committee that's been having incredible numbers of hearings, both in private and in public, dealing with the Russian attempts to influence our elections. And both of our senators are saying they want to talk to Mueller. They don't care whether it's a part of it in open, but some of it will have to be in closed session to find out what more Mueller has found out that he hasn't put in that report. Deals with issues that went before a grand jury, for example, because they could use that as they're trying to craft legislation to either block the Russians somehow technologically or hit them with sanctions once we find out that they've been doing something to try to influence our elections. So they're very interested in talking with Mueller about those aspects of it because it will help them craft some sort of legislation to try to protect us from Russian meddling in our elections.
And that's Maine's Political Pulse for this week. If you want to take Steve up on his recommendation to read the Mueller report yourself, you can link to it from the Maine Political Pulse webpage. A reminder, we record the Pulse each Friday, and it's available online Friday afternoons. We also air a long version of the Pulse on Weekend Edition Sunday with Jennifer Mitchell, and a shorter excerpt Mondays on Morning Edition. Willis Reiter Arnold is our producer. I hope you'll join Steve Missler, Mal Leary, and me for our next edition of Maine's Political Pulse.